morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'm coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. For those of you who don't already know, Glaxman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glaxman and Loretta Brennan Glaxman, Glaxman Ireland House, NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week, another busy one here at Glaxman Ireland House, and of course we're all looking forward to that Thanksgiving break, which unbelievably is upon us already. It only feels like yesterday that I was talking about the end of summer and Labor Day, and now all of a sudden, in the blink of an eye, it's Thanksgiving, and it feels like the semesters get busier and busier. Anyway, we had another great week here at Glaxman Ireland House. We were delighted to welcome back to NYU Caroline Hafey. Caroline is a doctoral student at UMass Amherst, and recently she penned the introduction to the republication of Dorothy McArdle's 1953 novel, Dark Enchantment. Fascinating insights from Caroline on McArdle and on this book that basically fell out of print very, very quickly, and it's wonderful to see those champions at Tramp Press in Dublin republishing it. So at some point I will take great delight in sharing with you the proceedings of that great event. Last week we had no less than the Irish Ambassador to the United States, Daniel Mulhall, here, and Dan gave a stellar lecture on comparing the Declaration of Independence and the striving of independence in 1776 in an American context with that of Ireland. Really interesting comparative look. We were delighted that Dan was willing to share this lecture with us. It was the 21st annual Ernie O'Malley Lecture, an annual lecture that we deliver every year in collaboration with Ernie O'Malley's son, Cormac K.H. O'Malley, and it was wonderful to welcome the ambassador to the United States from Ireland, Dan Mulhall, to deliver that annual lecture. Everyone, I have to say, was riveted, and dynamic question and answers afterwards. So on this week's program, I'm going to share with you the proceedings of Dan Mulhall's lecture. Now, before we go to that, just one last reminder. This weekend, in fact, today and tomorrow at the Irish Arts Centre, Dancing the Choral Suite, Dara Carr Dance with Musical Artists Dana Lynn and Kyle Sena, takes place over this weekend. And I highly encourage you folks, if you want to see some really great dance and choreography put to work and with some stellar musical accompaniment, please go to the Irish Arts Centre website. Performances this evening at 8 p.m, tomorrow at 2 p.m, and tomorrow at 7 p.m. Always such high quality performance from Dara and her team, and Dana Lynn is renowned as a wonderful musician on the fiddle. And she's accompanied by Kyle on guitar. And in order to whet your appetites a little bit, folks, I'm going to open up this week's program with the Choral Suite. They have generously shared this tune with us for us to share with you. So we'll go to that first, and then we will be going to the 21st annual Ernie O'Malley Lecture, as delivered by the Irish Ambassador to the United States, Daniel Mulhall. So, first to the Choral Suite, folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, for that warm welcome. I'm delighted to be back here. I spoke here last year, Oscuelga, and I'm delighted that enough people understood what I was saying to invite me back again to deliver this lecture in English, which I'm happy to do, although if you want me to switch to Irish at any time, please put your hand up, and I'll do my best. Okay. But, wherever I go in the world, I always approach my assignments through the lens of history, because, you know, I tend to, before I go to Germany, I bought a lot of books about Germany, I read a lot, and in Germany, of course, you can't avoid modern history. It's all around you, in Berlin especially, but also in other parts of Germany. And when I went to Britain, of course, London's a very historic city, and you can't avoid again immersing yourself in the history as a kind of a, and I find history is just the best way of getting to know a country, because it gives you a three-dimensional view of the country, and then you can fill in the gaps, you can fill in the picture when you're there living and working in the particular country. So when I came to the United States, I looked at my library, and I found that I had an extraordinary number of books on American history. I just somehow over the years, I didn't know I was ever going to end up in the United States. In fact, I thought I would not end up here, because having been in London, I thought that was probably it, and I wouldn't ever get a chance to serve in the United States. But it happened for me, and I then collected my books together and discovered that I had a library, really, of books on the United States and the history of America, and I've added to that library very considerably over the last 2 years. And also, when you travel around the United States, even though it's a young country, there's a lot of respect for heritage here. And earlier this year, I visited the University of Virginia. And when you're there, of course, I also visited Monticello, and I visited Montpellier, the home of James Madison. And of course, you can't help but think about the American Declaration of Independence. So in my visit to Jefferson's home and to the UVA campus, I started thinking about the Declaration of Independence. And I had this thought came to me that the American Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution is universally celebrated. It's one of these great events in world history. And nobody thinks it was a bad idea. I mean, I don't think you could find anywhere in the world who thinks, no, America should really have stayed loyal to the British Crown. But our revolution, on the other hand, is a much more contested space. It's, there's a consensus, obviously, in Ireland that it was a very good thing, but there are people in Ireland who are critical of our revolution. So I got to start thinking about, well, maybe as a historian, as an ambassador, I should compare the two processes, and I should try to explore the parallels and the differences, because there are major differences between those two great events. So it is an honor to be here, to be asked to deliver this year's Ernie O'Malley Lecture, and I want to thank the team at Glucksmann Ireland House for inviting me to be this year's speaker, and to Cormac O'Malley, who sadly is not here, for supporting this annual event in memory of his distinguished father. In fact, I met him. I'm wearing a badge given to me by about 20 veterans of the 2nd Battalion Association, who were over here for Veterans Day, and they were all dressed in their wonderful dark green blazers, and they also gave me a set of cufflinks, which I decided immediately to wear, because of course I'm talking about the origins of Ireland's contemporary defence force. It was great to meet these people today at the consulate. But I want to say that in a way, the topic I have today, which is this evening, which is the independence process in Ireland and comparing it with the American one, Ernie O'Malley is actually quite an important figure when it comes to understanding that period in our history. Because his story, which he recounts in his book On Another Man's Wound, in a way it parallels the story of Ireland between 1914 and 1922. If you start in January 1914, most Irish people would have been happy with Home Rule. Had Home Rule been granted in, had Home Rule become law in January, February or March of 1914. In fact, when the Home Rule Bill was passed in 1914, it was widely and enthusiastically welcomed in Ireland. People thought it was a great thing that we'd have finally achieved Home Rule after 40 years of the Home Rule Party in Westminster struggling against all the odds to deliver Home Rule. Finally delivered in 1914. Had it been implemented at that time, most people in Ireland would have said, yeah, that's what we wanted and we're happy with it. By 1918, nobody, or almost nobody in nationalist Ireland was happy with Home Rule. So, 1914, most people are saying Home Rule is fine. By 1918, there's a determination, and in the years that followed, to insist on an independent Irish Republic to be gained by force of arms. It's an extraordinary transformation. And Ernie O'Malley, in a way, epitomizes that transformation because, and in his book, he talks about, because he went from being a medical student at Trinity College in 1916, initially was against the Rising, then joined the Rising, and became a Republican warrior for the next 7 or 8 years of his life. And he talks about how his book, he says, is, I quote, the background of the struggle from 1916 to 1921 between an empire and an unarmed people. Now, that wasn't quite right because, of course, they did have some arms. He was one who certainly, couldn't have been regarded as unarmed. And he describes himself, and again, he may be embroidering things a little bit here, but that's fair enough. If people are entitled in their memoirs to be a little bit, nostalgic. He calls himself, I quote, a sheltered individual drawn from the secure seclusion of Irish life to the responsibility of action. Because he was from a family, his parents were, I suppose, moderate parliamentary nationalists who believed in Home Rule. He ends up as a very determined Irish Republican. How does that transformation occur? And what are the reasons why that transformation occurred? Now, as it happens, something similar happened in America in the 1760s and 1770s. Because if you turn the clock back to 1760, for example, America was a decidedly loyal part of the empire. Nobody in 1760 would have ever thought about the idea of independence for what? For 13 disparate colonies. And yet by 1776, America was a hotbed of revolution and demanding its independence and fighting for that independence against what was at that time the strongest empire in the world. So neither, in my view, neither the American nor the Irish revolutions were inevitable. There were, after all, many in America who remained loyal to the crown throughout the independence period, throughout the War of Independence, and some of them, I think there were about 80,000, 10,000 Americans fought for the British against independence in the United States. They fought for the British against American independence. And about 80,000 loyalists left this country. Many of them came back afterwards and settled here and, you know, were reintegrated back in. But many, there were many who didn't come back because they couldn't accept American independence. Likewise, the Irish Revolution was not inevitable. In fact, the 1916 Rising was a bit of a, it appeared to many at the time, as a bolt from the blue. Because, after all, it happened at a time when many Irishmen, some of them thoroughgoing nationalists, were actually fighting on the Western Front. And their families at home were receiving money generated by their menfolk who had enlisted for service in the First World War. So neither of the revolutions was really inevitable, but both of them happened. So what caused these transformations to occur? Now, the question in America really is, was the American Revolution the political embodiment of the Enlightenment ideas that Thomas Jefferson and others acquired in the period leading up to the Revolution? Or was it caused by a mishmash of events which drove Americans towards, ultimately, reluctantly, breaking the link with Britain? And in Ireland, we can ask, what role did ideals, nationalist ideology play, as opposed to the opportunities that were presented by the circumstances that arose during the First World War, which convinced some within the nationalist community that this is the time to strike for independence? Now, the American Declaration of Independence was an epoch-making event in global history. It played a vital role in ushering in the modern era in which we still live. And the words that Jefferson wrote in that declaration's opening paragraph, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Those are about the most famous words in the political history of mankind. There are hardly any words that can compare. Maybe Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, perhaps you could claim, might have some, it might provide some competition. On the other hand, Ireland's Declaration of Independence is hardly known at all. It was unfortunate, in a way, that the Declaration was issued on the 21st of January 1919, and that very same day, an ambush took place at Sonnehead Beg in County Tipperary, which is generally recognised to be the start, you know, the start of the War of Independence. So, in other words, the men of ideas producing a Declaration of Independence and other documents in Dublin that day were eclipsed by the activists in Tipperary, who ambushed an RIC convoy and killed a couple of the policemen and then made off with the weapons. So, an unfortunate coincidence that the two things happened the same day. And we now think about the War of Independence. We almost forget that there was a Declaration of Independence that was issued that day. And for example, Ernie O'Malley briefly quotes from the Declaration in his book, On Another Man's Wounds, but doesn't really dwell on it, doesn't make any comment about who wrote it, how it was written, where it was written, when it was written, nothing like that. Whereas we know practically everything about Jefferson's Declaration, because of course, at the time, maybe Jefferson and the others didn't think much of the Declaration, but by the time Jefferson died, he put on his tombstone, author of the Declaration of Independence. Didn't bother mentioning the fact that he was President of the United States, but that's another matter. Perhaps he knew how posterity would revere the words he wrote. But he recognised by the time he died that his words were actually canonical. Okay. As I said, I mean Robert Brennan, in his memoir of that period, Robert Brennan was the first Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs and became head of mission in Washington between 1938 and 1947. He doesn't mention it at all in his memoir of the period, Allegiance. And you can look at a whole range of histories of that period and you'll struggle to find a reference to the Declaration. I think there are very good reasons for regarding the Declaration as more important than we give it credit for. And I'll explain that. The reason for that, I think, is because the people who wrote that declaration and who adopted it in Dublin on the 21st of January 1919, they were all democratically elected. So whereas you can argue that the proclamation of Easter 1916 was issued by people who had no mandate to issue such a declaration, a proclamation, you could certainly, I think, be confident in saying that there was a mandate. Now, you can argue about the nature of the mandate and so forth, but there was certainly, those people had been elected by the people of Ireland in the first proper election ever held in Ireland, because, of course, the franchise was much wider than it had been at any time in our past history. Now, the American Declaration, obviously, the ideas of the Enlightenment, and I just read a book there recently by Bernard Bailyn about the ideological roots of the American Revolution. He makes it quite plain that there was a lot of Enlightenment ideas welling around America, not just Jefferson, but all kinds of obscure pamphleteers. Hundreds of pamphlets were written on various aspects that all paved the way for the Declaration to be issued in 1776. But it seems to me that it's hard to imagine. Let's say there was never an Enlightenment. It's hard to imagine that America would still be part of the British Empire. Right? In other words, it is hard to imagine that Britain could have kept control of America as it expanded westwards towards the Pacific, as the population was transformed by immigration from all over the world, including from Ireland. In other words, my assessment is that what caused the American Revolution was not so much the Enlightenment ideas, which of course were vital because they gave expression to a set of ideals which became very important to Americans and indeed to the wider world. What's important was the distance from London to America was such that it was inevitable that sooner or later the colonies would have drifted away from Britain, and it would be absurd to think that Britain could have, I mean, Washington could hardly rule America in the 19th century the way the country was developing and moving westward in the way it did. So America's history was shaped by westward expansion and by demographic change brought about by immigration. But the key thing to remember is that the tensions that began with the Stamp Act of 1765, it took 11 years to produce enough fuel to create a willingness on the part of those who met in Philadelphia to declare independence from America. Now, the American Revolution, strangely, didn't. I mean, it was a country, a political system, based on principles that had never before been applied anywhere in the world. And I'm sure at the time conservatives were fearful that these ideas would spread. They spread to France to some degree, but really nowhere else in Europe. And for example, between 1776 and 1918, apart from France, which declared a republic and went back to being an empire, then a republic, an empire, and so on, eventually ended up as a republic from 1870 onwards, apart from France, no other European country became a republic. In other words, the American formula for government didn't actually spread. It spread to Latin America, but what I've been able to read about that was that Americans didn't really rate the republics of Latin America. They saw them as being quite different in character. But in Europe, where you'd expect these ideas to have taken root, they didn't take root. Why? Because European societies were very different from America. They were settled societies where monarchism was much more deeply entrenched. Now, the American Revolution had a huge effect on Ireland. As Roy Foster has put it in one of his books, quote, "The radicalization of Irish political life was part of one great theme from the 1770s, the impact of America," end quote. And America, the American example, led to the rise of colonial nationalism, which morphed into republicanism in the 1790s and eventually gave rise to the rebellion, the rising of 1798. And the 1798 rising is actually the foundational moment in Irish nationalist history. Because before that, you had a very different political tradition. There was resistance to British rule, true, but this was a much more concerted and ideologically based opposition to British rule in Ireland. And for example, those who fought in 1916 and afterwards would have been very conscious of being in the tradition of Wolfe Tone and Robert Emmet and so forth, tracing their roots back to the 1798 rising. As Sean McEntee, who took part in the Easter Rising and became a minister in the Fianna Fáil governments in the 50s, 60s and 30s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, he said that without Wolfe Tone, quote, there might not have been arising, and almost certainly not a Republic of Ireland. So the point I make is that in Ireland there was a long tradition, which by the time we became independent in the 1920s, and by the time the Declaration was issued in 1919, had a history that was more than a century old. Whereas the American one, they had to invent something in a 10-year period. It's a very different type of experience. And also, of course, the aftermath of the 1798 rebellion tells you another story. It's the opposite. It's the reverse of the coin what happened in America. In America, the colonists were saved by distance. The British were too far away to be able to impose their will on the 13 colonies. And eventually they had to give up. America was also aided by the role played by France, the other great power in Europe at that time. In Ireland, the proximity killed any chance that the rising of 1798 could have succeeded. Because Ireland was so close to Britain that its freedom efforts, its efforts to break away, were not going to succeed because of the overwhelming power that Britain could bring to bear on Ireland. And throughout the 19th century, that was the key factor. There were quite a few uprisings, campaigns against tithes, campaigns in favour of land reform, and so forth. But none of these efforts could counter the reality that British power was too strong and near at hand, and therefore not possible for the native Irish to stand up to that power, whereas the Americans could do that because they were so much further away. The other factor, of course, in the Irish case was that there was a loyal community in Ireland, and they were concentrated in the northeast of Ireland. It was a very important factor in my view. In America, there were loyalists. As I mentioned, there were 80,000 people left the Americas, but they were scattered all over the country. And they didn't have the critical mass anywhere in any of the 13 colonies to block the movement towards independence. So, and of course, but this sustained resistance to British rule in Ireland just wasn't able to produce any outcome for Ireland because of its proximity to Britain and the determination and the fact that Britain regarded Ireland as intrinsic to imperial security. And therefore, and you know, when I hear people talk about Daniel O'Connell and the monster meeting at Clontarf, and some Republicans, some people in the nationalist point of view or strongly nationalist viewpoint say O'Connell missed a trick. He should have stood up against the British in Clontarf. Well, if you see what the British government was willing to do domestically in the 1830s and 40s to crush any dissent, you can just imagine what it would have been like had that monster meeting gone ahead against the wishes of the British government. I remember reading about the Great Reform Act of 1832 and reading an interesting line from the Duke of Wellington, who when he was Prime Minister, assured Her Majesty, Her Majesty, yeah, he assured her that the people of Britain are very, they will ultimately obey, the rules, but if they don't, we know how to deal with them. So my point is that Ireland was really up against it from the point of view of the disparity of power between Britain and Ireland at that time. Now, the 1916 proclamation is actually, I think, a very impressive document, and it has a ring to it, and I think it's all down to the influence of Patrick Pearse. In the name of God and the dead generations from which she receives her old traditions of nationhood, Ireland through us summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. So if Ireland had a Thomas Jefferson, it was probably Patrick Pearse. I know he's criticised sometimes for the sort of sanguinary rhetoric, but actually, if you read Jefferson, some of what Jefferson said as well had the same ideas in it of, the soil needing to be manured with the blood of patriots and so forth. So, 120 years later,
Pierce wasn't the only one ever to speak, you know, in those terms. Jefferson also did. Jefferson was in favour, for example, of the execution of Louis XVI, because he felt that he had it coming to him, and that every noble and every priest should be strung up to the nearest gallows. I mean, that was, you know, Jefferson. People sometimes, you know, can romanticise figures from the 18th century, but they were, you know, Jefferson wasn't a great fighter, and nor was Pierce, to be quite clear. But he was quite willing to, you know, to use language that we might now see as a bit over the top when it comes to urging violence, like others. Anyway, I'm not being critical of Jefferson, because I mean, obviously, what he did was a fantastic piece of work. But so my point then is that Patrick Pearse's embrace of Gaelic revivalism provided a spur to revolution in Ireland in ways not dissimilar from the impact of the Enlightenment on 18th century America. And for example, I go back to Robert Brennan, his book Allegiance. Now, he was actually a very representative figure in many ways. He rose to the top, Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Ambassador in Washington. Well, that I suppose is somewhere near the top anyway, I don't know about that. Well, it was in those days anyway, maybe not now, I don't know. He was a leading light, he was a founder member of the Gaelic League in Wexford, right? Number one. When Sinn Féin was established by Arthur Griffith, he joined Sinn Féin. And then later on, he was sworn into the IRB by Sean T. O'Kelly, who was an IRB organizer around the country. So he was in the three big movements that created the momentum that brought about Irish independence in the second and third decades of the 20th century. And what he wrote was, he said, in the late 19th century, and I quote, "Ireland's ancient culture was forgotten and debased English standards had taken its place. The political destinies of the nation were in the hands of the warring factions of what had once been the great Irish Parliamentary Party, whose members had now become mere tools of the British Liberal Party." End quote. Like many of his generation, Brennan gave credit to the Gaelic League, and he said it had set loose forces that were to, and I quote, "tear down the mighty and seemingly everlasting pillars of an alien civilization and set up in its place an Ireland in line with its ancient Gaelic culture." Now, of course, that didn't happen, but, you know, not everything that Jefferson wrote about in his various documents happened either, or at least not for a long time. So the point I'm making is that this kind of idealism was an important part of the Irish revolutionary moment. I'm not saying it caused a revolution, just like I'm not saying Enlightenment ideas caused a revolution here, because you needed the interplay of ideology and circumstance, opportunity. The opportunity being the First World War, and the upheavals caused by the First World War was akin to the upheavals caused in the aftermath in America of the of what was called the French and Indian Wars in this country. So, let me just... Now, the American Declaration is very interesting because it's famous for the lines that I quoted at the beginning. But actually, those lines are not in any way representative of the documents. So, Jefferson's text, if you read it in its entirety, and most people probably don't, because the body of it is more like a lawyerly list of grievances against the English king. It's a beautiful piece at the beginning, and there's a stuff at the end which is quite strong, but in between, it's like a laundry list of the terrible things that the King of England has done to America. So, for example, in the opening paragraph, before the famous lines I quoted, he says that when there is a need to dissolve established political bonds, it is necessary, and I quote, to declare the causes which impel them to the separation. In other words, we have to provide true cause. We can't just break away from England. We have to actually prove our case, almost like in court. And he said, and then in the main body of the declaration, there's a list of what he calls King George's, quote, "history of repeated injuries and usurpations, which had led to quote, an absolute tyranny over the colony. So, and then he goes on to list these things, and the grievances include 27 points in all, right? Charges of refusing to assent to laws, dissolving representative colonial assemblies, obstructing the administration of justice, interfering with the independence of judges, keeping standing armies in place in times of peace, and cutting off the colony's trade with the rest of the world. So in other words, England had a lot to answer for, according to Jefferson. But of course, one of the problems is that America was not an oppressed set of colonies in the 18th century. In fact, it was doing very well. But Americans became convinced that the British Crown and the British establishment was trying to undermine their liberties and put them into a kind of a condition of slavery. And that was why they felt the need to break free. And actually, he says that King George III is unfit, I quote, unfit to be the ruler of a free people. In other words, we're a free people, we've been free for ages, we're part of this English British nation, and now we're being told we're no longer free, we're being put upon by this king in England, and we have to break away. And the upshot of all of this was that he said, these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent. Now, the Irish Declaration was a very different type of document. Because unlike Jefferson's Declaration, there was absolutely no need to make a long laundry list of grievances against the British Crown. Let me just tell you what he did do. Now, and remember, Jefferson was very loyal. In fact, I have a quote here which I almost skipped over, but it's an important quote. And he said that he wrote in 1775, this is at the time of Concord and Lexington. Jefferson wrote that he would, quote, rather be independence on Great Britain, properly limited, than on any nation upon earth, or on no nation. In other words, he preferred to be under the domination of Britain than either under the domination of any other nation or of no nation. So this was not rabid republicanism on the part of Jefferson. It was something that evolved over time. It took 11 years. On the other hand, the 1918 election, which saw the triumph of Sinn Féin over the parliamentary party in all parts of nationalist Ireland, the parliamentary party held on to a few seats, but only because Sinn Féin didn't contest them. And the results were declared on the 28th of December, 1918. On the 2nd of January, 1919, the Sinn Féin headquarters in Harper Street, which is now the headquarters of Conor na Gaeilge, issued a letter to all those elected saying, meet next week in Dublin. Now, they didn't meet for another 2 weeks. But nonetheless, between the actual election results and the Declaration of Independence, you had 24 days. So this was whirlwind stuff. That's why we don't know who wrote the Declaration of Independence in Ireland's case. Because it all happened in a kind of a mad frenzy. Now, I have my, you know, I have my theory, which I'll give you in a second. So, instead of the laundry list of complaints against Britain, our declaration says, whereas for 700 years the Irish people has never ceased to repudiate and has repeatedly protested in arms against foreign usurpation, end quote. English rule in Ireland was described as, quote, based upon force and fraud and maintained by military occupation against the declared will of the people. So straightforward, it was the 700 years of British rule, that was enough. There was no need to go through this long recitation of detailed complaints against Britain. This was a straightforward declaration of independence. So in other words, no need to go into a detail, a pithy reference to British rule in Ireland would be sufficient to justify breaking away. So the members of the First Dáil pledged themselves, and I quote, to make this declaration effective by every means at our command. This is a brave thing to do. So remember, two-thirds of those elected were in jail at the time, including Robert Brennan. He was in jail in Britain. And they were facing, let's face it, they were up against a power, the British Empire, that had just won the bloodiest war in human history and had demonstrated a degree of ruthlessness in the conduct of that war, which, you know, ought to have made people at that time rather worried, rather wary of what they might have been able to do in Ireland. So it was a brave thing to do, just like it was a brave thing for those in Philadelphia in 1776, because again, they were up against a very successful empire, which was very likely, as it did, come and try to bloody the noses of the independence movement and its supporters. So, and that's, of course, well, what I've said there about you know, that's similar to Jefferson's text. Jefferson's text says, "And for the support of this declaration, with firm reliance on protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." So both declarations concluded this commitment to do everything necessary to achieve the goals of these declarations. Echoing the American Declaration again, its Irish counterpart insisted that only the elected representatives of the Irish people had the right to make laws binding on the Irish people. Very similar to what Jefferson was saying in his declaration. And also, of course, there was a demand for the evacuation of what was called the English garrison in Ireland, akin to what Jefferson would have wanted in the 18th century. So while there was no soaring passage to match Jefferson's evocation of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the Irish Declaration does contain an aspirational agenda, quote, "to promote the common weal, to re-establish justice, and to constitute a national policy based upon the people's will, with equal rights and equal opportunity for every citizen." So it's pretty good liberal sort of affirmation of what the revolution was seeking to do. So the declaration was accompanied by two other documents, which in themselves have overshadowed the Declaration of Independence, which was kind of taken for granted. That was really seen as a reiteration of the proclamation of 1916. And those declarations those documents were an address to the free nations of the world and the democratic program. The address is aimed unmistakably at an American audience because it describes Ireland as the gateway to the Atlantic. That was clearly aimed at the overseas Irish. It goes on to point out that, quote, "Ireland is the last outpost of Europe to the West. Ireland is the point upon which great trade routes between East and West converge." In other words, it was asserting Ireland's role as an Atlantic country, akin to the United States. The address led to the dispatch of a delegation to the Versailles conference, and although they had strong Irish-American support, they couldn't get a hearing for Ireland's claims, and that's probably the reason why the War of Independence took off in the way it did, because it clearly convinced people that it wouldn't be possible by persuasion, even though Ireland's case was clearly in line with the principles that President Wilson had set out the year before. So, now, while the composition of the American Declaration is a storied event, the origins of its Irish equivalent are a mystery. It was written in a rush between December 28th, 1918, and 21st of January 1919. According to the nationalist historian Dorothy McCardle, the documents approved by the First Dáil were composed by a committee consisting of the lawyer George Gavan Duffy, who had been the defence lawyer for Roger Casement at his trial for treason in 1916, and was part of the team that negotiated later on, the team that negotiated the Treaty of 1921, the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and was briefly Ireland's first foreign minister. The second person involved was the writer Piers Beasley, who was an Irish language writer, born in Liverpool, but a very strong Irish language writer, and then the political activist Sean T. O'Kelly. Now, of the three, given that the declaration was issued in three languages, French, Irish, and English, my guess is that the Irish version was written by Beasley, who was a strong Irish scholar. That the French version was written by George Gavan Duffy, because he had lived part of his life in France and presumably spoke quite good French. And that the English version was written by Sean T. O'Kelly. That'd be my guess. Although, funny enough, nowhere in any of the literature have I found any evidence. It is clear that O'Kelly rewrote the Democratic Programme. The Democratic Programme was drafted first by the leader of the Labour Party. And it was regarded by those in side, they wanted the Labour Party to support the independence movement, but they didn't want to go too far down the line of being socialist and being criticized by the church for being excessively radical. So Johnson, the Labour Party leader's text, was rewritten by Sean Kilkenny. So we know that he was involved in rewriting that, and my guess is that he probably wrote the Declaration of Independence. Now, like Jefferson, of course, he can't compare with Jefferson. He's no Jefferson, clearly. But he did go on to occupy some of the most senior posts in 20th century Ireland. President, Deputy Prime Minister, and Minister of Finance during a very long political career. And the key thing is, just like Jefferson in 1776, O'Kelly was in his 30s when he wrote the Declaration, if I'm right in my conclusion that he did write it. So what you have here is a young generation of people throwing off the shackles of the older fuddy-duddies who weren't prepared to take this bold step and being bold and brave. Jefferson in the 1770s, O'Kelly and his contemporaries in 1919. Now, obviously, neither declaration led to an immediate independence for either America in the 1770s or for Ireland in 1919, but both struggles took a number of years. In the American case, it took 7 years to achieve independence. In the Irish case, it took another 3 years, say, from 1919 to 1922. And of course, you know, there were very, very different struggles, because while in America you had a struggle that was, it was an 18th century type struggle with people, with armies, recognizable armies on both sides. Okay, the British one more disciplined, the American one less so, but nonetheless, both led by people who knew how to fight wars. Obviously, the Irish one was very different. It was a guerrilla warfare. It was the 20th century, one of the first 20th century guerrilla warfares. Other countries clearly took heed of what happened in Ireland and followed the Irish example. In the Irish case, of course, it led to a civil war within 3.5 years. Of the Declaration of Independence, Ireland was embroiled in a civil war. But like America, which of course the civil war was much later, but like America, Ireland, against all the odds, I mean, who would have said, in the 1770s, even Americans, a lot of them didn't think America could survive, because this had never been done before. There was a lot of alarm, and you had John Adams and others, some of the Federalists, wanting to create a monarchy, because that was the only form of government that they thought was really viable. So, in the Irish case, the success of the Irish Revolution was not made in 1922, it was made in 1932, when you had a transfer of power from those who had lost the civil, from those who had won the Civil War to those who had lost it. And from, to me at least, Ireland, independent Ireland, proved itself on that day in 1932 when power was peacefully transferred from those bitter rivals of 10 years before. So, the other thing, of course, about America, which is different from Ireland, a lot of the founding fathers of the Irish Revolution didn't survive. I mean, you think about it. The 16, they weren't all leaders, but certainly some of them were people of quality. Lord Pearse would have been quite an interesting cabinet minister in independent Ireland. MacDonagh would have been probably a very good education minister or whatever, and so there was enough talent, a lot of talent there. Arthur Griffith didn't survive either. Many people lost their lives in the Civil War, the War of Independence. Michael Collins didn't survive. So, you know, there was a lot of losses sustained. In the American case, actually, the longevity of the founding fathers of America is really quite striking. And it did certainly give America an opportunity to settle itself down after the upheavals of the 1770s and 1780s. But it wasn't without its difficulties. You know, the competition between Adams' vision of America and Jefferson's vision became quite nasty in the late 18th century, and it took a while for that turbulence to quieten down. So, the world of the 1770s, in which America emerged as an independent nation, was very different from the post-First World War era which Ireland declared its independence. The American Declaration came at the beginning of a new era in world history, which it was instrumental in creating. Irish independence came at the end of that era, as war and revolution remade the world at Versailles, just as the Treaty of Paris did 136 years earlier. The long 19th century between the American and Russian revolutions was a period during which Ireland developed a distinctive national political identity, with demands for self-government couched in various terms and pursued by different means, but always unsuccessfully, until the First World War provided the opportunity for Ireland to become independent. In the second half of the 19th century, America became a factor in Irish politics, as post-famine Irish immigrants and their descendants supported Irish movements at home. British concern about the capacity of Irish America to complicate UK-US relations, which were vital to Britain at the time, played a major part, in my view, in the UK decision to concede independence to Ireland. The Irish and American revolutions, separated by 140 years, were similar in a number of respects. It succeeded because, in both cases, the metropolitan government made important missteps and they fatally underestimated their opponents. In the very different circumstances in which they operated, both sets of revolutionaries exhibited tenacity and determination, which eventually saw them triumph against the odds of power politics. Ireland's declaration is clearly a cousin of its American counterpart. Even the choice of title seems to me to suggest that a conscious comparison was being sought to be made between the two. Our declaration was also the heir to a rich vein of nationalist thought from Wolfe Tone in the 1790s to Robert Emmet in 1803, the of Ireland in the 1840s, and the Fenian movement in the 1860s. Plus the many Irish parliamentarians at Westminster who kept the flame of Irish independence, a separate Irish political identity, alive through those dark decades of the 19th century. I do not expect the Irish Declaration of Independence ever to acquire the iconic status enjoyed by Jefferson's masterwork, but in my view, it ought to be better known than it is. Thank you very much.
And that was Ambassador Dan Mulhall, who was here from Washington, D.C. to deliver the 21st Ernie O'Malley lecture here at Luxman Ireland House a week ago last Thursday. So I hope you enjoyed that fine performance from Dan. Just to remind you folks before we wrap up, our Ornall na Nullag, that's the annual Christmas concert, will take place on Thursday, December 5th at 7 p.m. We'd be delighted to see you there. Before that, actually, at 5 p.m. that evening here at Luxman Ireland House, that's Thursday, December 5th, we will also host an MA open house where one can come by and find out information about the Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies. So please feel free to join for that. Of course, there is still one more Blarney Star concert. The December concert is something that I don't want you to lose track of, and they take place on a Friday and they take place at 8 p.m. They start a little bit later than our own regular events, and that next one and the final one for 2019 will be on Friday, December 13th. Jan Falquet, Shannon Heaton and George Keith will be here. So we're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you from Luxman Ireland House at New York University on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. Thanks for tuning in to us, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.